Revolting. Ani speaks to Judith Arquette and takes your calls. At 9 on Pacific Underground, musician Joe Kai plays live, talks about his upcoming shows and his experience becoming a U.S. citizen. At 10, it's Valley Views. They talk about how to eat and enjoy a plant-based diet. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly talks fan fiction. Call in and share your story ideas for popular characters. Plus, KBOO will be webcasting live from the Occupy Ice Portland encampment at 11:30 this morning with host Ken Jones. Check kboo.fm to listen live. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO, in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee has been rescheduled to July 11th at 7 p.m. Please join us.
While in Atlanta, Danny Lyon joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and acted as staff photographer from 1962 to 1964. His first solo photography book, The Bike Riders, A Study of Outlaw Motorcyclists, was published in 1968. Following his publication of The Bike Riders, Lyon completed documentary work on the Texas prison system. Lyon's work is very personal and gives us, the viewer, access to people and places we wouldn't normally get to see.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Danny Lyon will be in Portland to show the films Willie and Murderers. Again, that's the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting the return of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones with the David Grisman Trio and the Jerry Douglas Band, Saturday, July 14th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Tickets and more information at zooconcerts.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani, and this morning I am very pleased to say that in the studio joining me is Judith Arcana. She is a poet, she's an activist, she is an amazing all-around community asset, wonder, resource, wise woman in the community, yeah. and is entering her second year of hosting her very own KBOO poetry show, which is Poetry and Everything, and you can hear that once a month on our poetry extravaganza on Monday evenings. And I'm very happy to welcome you back to Positively Revolting, Judith.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here. Glad to be invited.
Absolutely. And so, when we were initially talking about this show, you have a reissue of a poetry book that we'll talk about specifically in a moment, but it started me thinking about why I was excited to have you on and welcome you as a poet this time. We've talked about activism in the past, and we've talked about women's reproductive justice issues, which you've been very involved with throughout your life, and yet this time really focusing on poetry. And I started being curious about the excitement I had to actually speak to you as a poet this time. And I realized, because to me, the world we live in, it's on fire. I think there's no denying that. There's emergencies around every corner.
Absolutely.
And as my friend Phil and I were discussing a year ago, it seems like there's no bottom to the disasters, to the horrors that are around us right now. It's like the race to the bottom is ongoing, and we haven't found the basement yet. And with all of this, poetry seems to me to be more essential than ever, right? And I find that a curious response in myself. Like I gravitate towards words for balm. And I wanted to have a conversation with you about the importance of poetry when the world's on fire.
I'm sure have already understood about me, given what you just explained. I am also, like you, I'm a believer in the value of words, word art, as I call it, both poetry and prose, but certainly poetry in the sense that, I'll just throw out some thoughts as responses to your opener. Poetry is lyrical in a way that very little prose is. Really fine prose can be quite lyrical, and of course, when we're writing prose, we aim for that. But poetry is that, by definition, almost all the time. And so one of the things that happens with writing it, reading it aloud, reading it to yourself with a book in your hands, memorizing it, performing it on stage, whatever, is that it's in your body as well as in your mind. The rhythm and the sensibility of that lyrical quality, I think, are constant in seriously wrought poetry. Obviously, it's a little lighter when we're doing stuff like Mother Goose rhymes or crazy street rap, but it's still there. In fact, those two examples are wildly rhythmical.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and come right into your body. So I think that, first of all, is important, or is one of the important reasons that poetry can be valuable, effective, and desired, both desired and desirable, in the time of horror, as you put it. I think that's the right word for it. I often refer to this time as our national horror show. And it's not like we've not had horror in our past, but this, as you explained, Donnie, is constant.
Yeah.
Absolutely constant, every day, many times a day. So poetry, and the word you used, poetry can be a balm. That's right. This thing about the mind-body connection, I'm going to get all karmic on us here and zen and yogic, but that combination in the form, I think, is at least partly responsible for the response that you're describing.
Yeah, thank you. That works for me. There is something that's very centering about being wrapped with words. And it offers us a chance to see the world in different ways. It offers us a chance to see the world through different eyes and different lenses. And that is going to bring me into speaking about your book, Fourth Period English. And so Fourth Period English was a book you initially wrote in 2009.
It came out in 2009. I actually probably started it in 2008, so 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is a book really about immigration, about different individuals' responses to immigration.
Yes.
And it's now just been reissued by Eberhard Press.
Yes, here in Portland.
And I can't imagine a more timely topic, actually.
Well, the publisher and I certainly thought so, to our surprise.
Right.
10 years later, yeah.
What started you on this project of writing Fourth Period English?
As usual, a combination of things, even though there might have been one spark moment. Sometimes that happens, just like in the movies. However, in real life, it's usually a complicated set of things. And about 10 years ago, I spent some time with the people at Graham Street Productions, a film company, the Rebecca and Anne, the two people who are the producer and director there, were working on a film called Papers. And the title refers to the papers you need to be a citizen, the papers you need to get into and stay in this country, or any country for that matter. Mm-hmm. And they were focusing on young people, really young people, high school students, or even sometimes I think there were middle school students. And in their house, around the dining room table, there were always kids who were learning to do radio, kids who were learning to do TV, kids who were learning, of course, film, because they were making a movie, kids who were making their own emotional lives into fuel to create art, to talk about the politics of immigration and how it worked or didn't in their lives. Mm-hmm. These are the young people, of course, we call and have called since the Dreamers. Mm-hmm. And so I don't even remember what I, you know, there would be a call for people come and help this, you know, is the envelope stuffing or whatever, you know. And I would show up there and I would spend time with not only the grown-ups that I knew, but these kids. And also, there was an event somewhere in that year, 10 years ago, at the Kennedy School, where a group of them stood up and talked to the audience. And they were just so impressive to me, so young, so vulnerable, and so deeply thoughtful and earnest, and of course passionate about this subject, which was affecting their whole families, their lives, and as they were beginning to understand, the life of the whole nation, really. And then, of course, had we gone into it further, naturally it's global. So those kids really just, and also I should add this, in another life, a thousand years ago, I was a high school teacher, and I hadn't done a lot of time with high school kids in many of the decades since, other folk, both teaching and learning with them. And here they were again. And I think that my history as a high school teacher and the fact of these young people came together around this major league social, political, cultural issue. And these characters started literally showing up in my head. And they weren't the kids that I had met. They weren't the people I heard speak from the stage. They were strangers, so to speak. And after a while, after I had a few of these poems that are people talking, I realized that this was a scene, that this was a situation, and hence the title, Fourth Period English. I invented a teacher for them, high school English teacher, Natch, as I had been, and she had assigned to them the topic of immigration, and they're talking and arguing about it in all of these pieces in the book.
And so you have written these, basically these monologues, in the various student voices.
Yes.
And one could imagine some of these students are from other places, from other countries, are having the experience of being immigrants or being first generation even.
Definitely. Some of their parents came, mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you're having also the monologues of the kids that just don't get it.
Definitely don't get it.
Right.
Right.
And so there's not really interplay between them because it's a series of monologues, each person speaking their experience, and I found that to be really powerful. How did you decide on that form? I mean, there's a little something like the vagina monologues.
Uh-huh.
when I was reading.
Wow, I never thought of that. But you're totally right. Yeah,
that's how this hit me, and I've always thought that was a very powerful piece, mm-hmm. As it explored various valid relationships with women and our sexuality and mm-hmm. our relationship to our own bodies.
Right.
And here you have again the series of monologues that are each a standalone piece with this deep reflection on the immigrant experience.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because my goal, my hope, is that each one is a standalone piece, even though in my head and in the order that I put them, I tried to have them sort of be, well, again, like the vagina monologues, sort of be in response to mm-hmm. each other. There are even a couple where the person speaking refers to someone else, but isn't necessarily, although there may be one where it sounds like he's Cesar, I think he's actually talking to somebody. But anyway, that part doesn't matter, I guess, as much as what you said, which is, there they all are in fourth period English with their teacher and a few other adults who show up and in the book. And some of them have obviously thought a lot about this. And as usual, that's because they are the ones whose lives have sustained major league impact. Despite their youth, they've had to think about, feel, deal with yeah. all of this stuff. The quote-unquote American kids, white kids, kids who don't quite get it that their own people also, surprise, are immigrants, with one exception. There is a student in the book who is from the Native Nations of North America and makes that very clear in her piece. But the other quote-unquote Americans have not had to. It's just like right now, mm-hmm. which is why we brought the book back.
Yeah, it's
people who have not had, out of privilege, white privilege, you know, class privilege, the list, mm-hmm. not had to think about this stuff the way these kids think about it every day, all day long.
So I want to, before we open up the phone lines and invite people in, the one interplay that I did really, it really caught me was Raquel, who, as you you have a note as to how these monologues are happening, Raquel talking, or say Jason talking inside his head.
Mm-hmm.
You have Raquel talking, and then skipping over Jason in his head. You have Ashley talking a lot.
Yes,
and she is directly referring back to Raquel's experience and what she has learned.
Yes,
you know, from her classmate.
Yeah,
can you read Raquel's piece?
Sure. Let me find her.
She's page 18.
Thank you.
Sure. And I do want to remind you, you are listening to KABU. It's your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani, and my guest this morning is Judith Arcana.
Okay, so this one is Raquel talking. Now, I think maybe I will have to leave, go back where I came from, like you say all the time, you know? Except I didn't come from there. I came from here, like you. Yeah, from Springfield. I never lived outside the States. Visiting used to be okay, but now it's hard. My mother's from El Salvador. I'm not. She came 3 months pregnant with me. She came when they killed her brothers. Later, they killed her father, too, but she didn't see it that time. She just imagines it. I never saw them at all, my uncles, Tios Raul, Eliseo, y Baltasar. I never saw my grandfather, except in pictures. If we try to stay here, maybe you will kill my brothers. I heard that happened in Nevada, or maybe it was Idaho.
And go ahead and skip over to Ashley.
And then here's Ashley talking a lot. Listen, guys, I have to tell you this. Last night, like on my way to work, I'm on the streetcar, and I hear this guy talking. I mean, real loud, like a crazy person does, or like a drunk. But he wasn't drunk. He was talking to this lady next to him, but she wasn't with him. She didn't even know him. She stood up, got off at the library, but he kept talking, you know? Nobody's sitting there, but he's talking, and nobody's looking at him. Everybody's looking away. You know how you do. People were, like, rolling their eyes, looking away. But wait, wait, here's the thing. Why I'm telling you this is, this guy on the streetcar was like all about our assignment. This guy is like the most anti-immigrant guy ever, I swear. Really. Listen, here's how he sounded. I'm not eating no tacos, that's for sure. None of that. Nothing like that, 'cause I'm an American. And you can see that, can't you? Why should I have to talk to them? They should have to talk to me. Coming here like they do. Let them talk American if they come here. Know what I mean? I was born here, right? I'm a goddamn citizen. Excuse me, Miss Solomon, but that's what he said. I swear to God, that's what he talked like. That's just what he said. And first I thought, oh, he's loud, he's rude. I'm glad I'm not sitting next to him. But then, you know how sometimes you hear stuff and it's only sound? It could be anything. Then, all of a sudden, what it is comes in, and, like, you get it? So that happened to me on the streetcar. And so I thought about our class, about Raquel, yesterday. He could be one of the guys she told about, the ones in Nevada or Utah. Wait, was it Utah?
Thank you.
It's my girl, Ashley.
Yes. I can so relate to Ashley.
Well, yeah.
You know, that rush of needing to share an experience that causes that breakthrough, that has that epiphany moment.
Yes. Right? Here she is, this kid. And like she explains, it's just sound. And then all of a sudden, whoa, thought happens.
Right.
Actual thought happens. Yeah, and I'm a big user of public transportation, so whether it's a streetcar or MAX or a bus, I have experiences like that where it's, and then all of a sudden, something comes in and I think, whoa, did he say that?
Right. Well, and it's an interesting way to keep in touch with the pulse.
Oh, yes.
You know, of what's going on around us.
Definitely.
You know, and then myself, I can relate, because as an extrovert, when I have those epiphany moments, mm-hmm. I need to process verbally mm-hmm. and talk a lot, mm-hmm. as the case may be. Hence, I host talk radio in the mornings here on KABU to process. So I want to invite you, dear listeners, to call on in and process with us. What are your thoughts about poetry, about the impact of words on our world, and how we make a difference through the expression, through art? If you ever wanted to talk to a poet, this is your chance. Call on in. 503-231-8187 is the number for the studio this morning. You are listening to KABU, your very own community radio station. And I just want to give you a little preview about what's coming up this morning. At 9 o'clock, we will have the Pacific Underground and musician Joe Kai. He's playing live in studio and talking about his upcoming shows and his experience in becoming a U.S. citizen. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views talks about how to eat and enjoy a plant-based diet. At 10:15, we'll hear from Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, a Radio Geekly talks about fan fiction. You can call in and share your stories and your ideas for popular characters in fan fiction. Plus, KABU will be webcasting live from the Occupy ICE encampment at 11:30 this morning with host Ken Jones. Check kboo.fm to listen live to the web stream broadcast or web stream streamcast, yeah, of the Occupy ICE Portland encampment at 11:30. All of this goes on because of your support. All of the KABU programs are made possible because you care enough to contribute to this radio station and become members. If you would like to become a member or to help to sustain us now, just go to kboo.fm and click the donate button. It is about 23 minutes after 8, so do give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we, let's see, where to go from here. Judith, there are so many things. I think that right now we should go ahead and get to the phone call. Norm, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Ani. Thank you. I like your show.
Cool. Thanks for calling in.
I'd like to ask your guest, what poets have you read in your life that that have affected you deeply or influenced you or just made you smile?
Oh, I like the last part. Lots of them, so many. And I'm going to open with the most obvious, but it's totally true in my case. And of course, it's Shakespeare. When I was 17, starting college, I was totally blown away to read the plays. Although now I definitely believe that watching them and listening and being in the audience is more useful for me in human terms than reading them. But at the time, I just thought, whoa, I mean, I could barely believe that, you know, that this could be words on a page. So opening with the great one, and then moving very swiftly to our moment in time. Right now, I'm reading Ross Gay, who is completely wonderful, has a great heart and a great mind and great skill as a poet. Naturally, I am of a generation to have been extremely strongly influenced by Adrienne Rich, both her poetry and her prose, particularly her nonfiction, her essays. But the poems, in fact, I'm probably going to be reading one of them on my own poetry show this month. I always read one of my poems and one of somebody else's. So this month it's going to be Adrienne Rich. Her thinking, as much as her skill as a poet, and the presence of that thinking in the art, in the poems, was amazing to me. It still is amazing to me. How do we get that kind of thinking into art and magic? One of the things about poetry that distinguishes it, when it is distinguished from prose, is that it's much shorter. And what that means, to me as a writer and even as a teacher of writing, is that you have to really keep condensing, keep, in a sense, melting down so that you take away everything that is dross. And the poets that have influenced me the most, whether they're conversational, like, let's say, Sharon Olds, or wildly excellent at form, like Rita Dove, They are doing that. They are about that. So those are a few names, Norm. I could make huge lists. Maybe someday I will. You may have a list, someone interested as you are. But thanks for asking.
I really like Linda Hogan.
Oh, Linda Hogan is completely wonderful. No wonder you do. And another one whose essays are extremely valuable and quite lyrical.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call this morning, Norm. Take care. 503-231-8187. We're taking a moment this morning to discuss poetry and its relevance and importance in our world that is so affected by dire happenings, often emanating from our administration and leadership of this country.
Which are not poetic.
No.
Our current administration is not lyrical.
No.
Alas.
Sadly.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
And so, in your work, you have What If Your Mother? I'm going to jump from fourth period English to the first work of yours that I read. And your history as somebody who has been so very involved with reproductive justice and ensuring women's access to safe abortion services, to advocating that women actually control our destiny and biology. You know, I think it's very important.
Yeah, to say that.
And I very much appreciate your work in this.
Thank you.
And then to sort of distill the experiences of that and your thoughts on motherhood in general, you have this collection. You want to go ahead and talk about What If Your Mother?
What If Your Mother? This is another origin story, like the questions that Ani asked me about how I came to write fourth period English. I had done a certain amount of work in earlier years, but in the late 90s, I had the epiphanic kind of experience that you were alluding to, and I had no plans, like less than zero plans to be writing poems about abortion and adoption and IVF and other related mumsy topics, but the lightning bolt struck, so mumsy, in the kitchen. It even involved eggs. The story is actually in the preface to this book, which is called What If Your Mother, that Ani is referring to. And once, just like with the young people in fourth period English, these notions started showing up in my head, and finally I thought, okay, fine. It's like talking to your own brain. All right, this is what you want. We'll do this.
So what I'm catching is being a poet is very much listening to the voices inside your head and externalizing them.
Yes, I think that's a very good way to put it. It's also true that being a poet requires, like what I said about riding the buses and trains, listening to the voices outside your head.
Yeah.
And when they come in, then they're cohabiting with the voices inside your head, and stuff happens. Then you have to wrestle it down into what's really good. Obviously, it's very, very rare to just copy it down and have it be art. We like that when it happens, but it happens maybe twice in a couple hundred years for any individual writer. So you've got to wrestle with it. So anyway, that happened to me in the late 90s, and I began writing what became this collection, What If Your Mother? And although I knew the most about contraception and abortion, I began to do the research. I even got a couple research grants, which was very cool to go to places and read stuff, like at the Rockefeller Archives in New York State. Those people in the first third of the 20th century put a lot of work and money into stuff about contraception and abortion, some of it not for the best reasons, but definitely came to be of good use. So I'm learning all this stuff and then making that into poetry. Like IVF is not particularly lyrical in itself. I have a friend who's doing a lot of research on frozen embryos and other kinds of ways of making people, which are quite new in the history of human being. But that's all now part of maternity.
Right.
And, you know, the creation of humans by other humans, it's pretty different from what most people thought for most of the time until like 2 seconds ago, historically speaking.
Yeah.
So may I read a couple from this?
Is that okay? I would love that.
Okay. Well, I think I'll actually read, Oh, here's the very first one. Okay. This poem is called Eggs, and it literally came out of that moment I just referred to. Separating eggs in the kitchen, she is separating argument from fact, the babies. All that yelling while the babies are inside. They're all yolk and sticky. They are eggy babies. Pouring slow yolk from one broken shell to another, letting the white slip down the sink, saving the yellow for chocolate cake, banana bread, hollandaise, while their heads are big and glazed, their eyes are ping-pong balls, hands like paddles, tiny spines like rubber whips, slower than chickens, slower than cats and dogs. We argue months while they roll inside their outer space, thickening. And of course, after I wrote the poem, which I called Eggs, I had to write one called Sperm. So here's that one. In science class, we learned sperm cells carried whips, flagellates, the teacher said. We pictured medieval fanatics from history class who hurt themselves to love their god. One day, the teacher had a thin, bright snake sliding through the belt loops on his khakis. He let us touch it, saying, "This one looks like a coral snake, but he can't hurt you." You can just imagine what we thought, said, drew in our notebooks. From cartoons, we moved to textbook illustration, slides on the microscope stage. You? We never smelled semen, only formaldehyde, plastic chairs, and aftershave. But there they were, jerky, blind, hesitant little swimmers with tails of thread, like tadpoles you catch in a jar, then wait for the legs to jut, muscular angles, to kick with knobby-fingered webbing, to bump up chunky heads, no necks like third-year football players. But sperm would never leap right into moonlight, shivering in black pond water. Sperm were frantic as they thrashed across the thin glass slide, no egg nearby. Finally, they dropped their tails, melting into communion on a movie screen above the chalkboard. Someone had filmed their kamikaze ecstasy to teach us. They didn't care about being watched. We saw them whip their tiny bodies toward the beloved egg, pierce her membrane, and then die, mimicking the men who made them, pumping and thrusting through their cloud of milt until they get there, release, fall away. I couldn't believe I was finding the lives of sperm tragic, you know, but it does seem that way. Yeah.
You know?
It does seem that way.
And so we have really a lot of the human drama.
Yes.
Played out right there in the
initial miniature, to say the least.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started thinking about all that stuff way beyond, or way inside of, maybe I should say, the original concerns that I had come to much earlier in my life, thinking about access to abortion health care, access to contraception. And this was before the Roe decision, when I first came into that kind of thinking.
All right.
Yeah. And now we're back in a big way.
Yeah. And I would, you know, jumping from the lyric world, from poetry and interpreting the world around us, to looking at really some of the dangers that we're facing, where it seems like everything old is new again.
Mm.
Right? That we have this critical vacancy on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of conjecture about what's going to happen. And we're looking at the makeup of what could be the, well, I mean, I was going to say the end of Roe. The beginning of the end of Roe started years ago,
indeed,
a couple of decades
right.
ago, yes, with the Webster decision.
Exactly.
You
yes.
know, but carrying on, chipping away at Roe little by little, mm-hmm. now looking at the very real possibility of it ending. What is that? How does that hit you, Judith?
Well, much the way I can tell from what you're saying, it hits you and, of course, millions of others, in that sometimes people have thought in the United States that once a Supreme Court decision has been made, or once a law is, quote, on the books, that's it. But that's never been true, literally never, and it sure isn't now. I am one who's been anticipating the overturn of Roe for a little while now, and so now it seems to me the retirement of Kennedy simply speeds up that process. I think it'll put us back to where we were a year or two before the Roe decision, and because of the contemporary effects of the anti-abortion movement, which began, I place it in the late 70s, early 80s, got a lot of traction in the 80s, of course, right. in the Reagan years, but really did begin with the Hyde Amendment, in the 70s. That was 76, I guess it came into effect in 77, making it virtually impossible for poor women and certainly very young women, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I think, in answer to your question, I mean, we could go on forever, so I'm trying not to. trying to make a clear statement here that is only saying a couple things instead of a couple hundred things. I think
it's a big question.
It is a big question. Thank you. I appreciate that latitude. I think that what's going to happen is that we're going to find ourselves in the place, strictly speaking, that we were pre January of 73, which is when the Roe decision came down, but at the same time in the mindset that now exists in the United States because of the powerful effects of the deliberate anti-abortion movement of the last four plus decades.
Right.
And that is stuff that we did not have to deal with in the 60s and the 70s when the underground abortion work that I came to was happening. People did not feel and think the way about abortion or even contraception the way so many people have been socialized to think and feel now. So that's going to be news and make things a little ugly, or maybe a lot uglier. Yeah.
Yeah, I had not actually... Well, being born in 66, I had not actually thought about what attitudes were there.
Oh, yeah.
Only that it was inaccessible to most women.
Yeah.
And the necessity of the underground services and linking women to these essential services by however we could. But I hadn't actually thought or engaged in conversation about the attitudes around abortion in the 60s and 70s.
And although I knew in the 80s and earlier 90s that this stuff was happening, and of course had, you know, written, spoken, done some stuff, but prior to writing What If Your Mother, I really hadn't thought it through in the way that we're talking about it right now. And one of the things that happened, part of the research I alluded to, was asking a few clinics. This was in 98, 99, 2000. Wait a sec. Time for coughing. I asked a couple of clinics here in Portland if I might visit, because I hadn't done this kind of work since pre-Roe, when we were underground. And these wonderful people said yes, and some of the women who were, and girls, who were coming through the appointments on those days also said yes when they were asked, Judith is doing some research, she's a writer, blah, 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 and she has done this work before medically, is it okay if? And a good number of them said yes, blessings on them. And here's what happened to me. So there I am, sometimes literally standing right next to them, sometimes even holding a hand, just like in the old days, except legal and everyone's in scrubs.
Right.
And, you know, it's all looking very medical industry style. And I was so blown away by the vibe, the attitude, the feeling, the emotional energy coming off of these folks who came in, which was so different from what I had experienced. There was, this is the part that really just drove me out of my mind, so much shame, which I had literally no memory of ever encountering in the pre anti-abortion movement years. And not only shame, but its accompaniment, which is a kind of internalization that comes from an internalization of huge amounts of emotion and thought that comes from not sharing it with anyone, not telling. I remember there was one woman at one clinic who they asked her all the appropriate questions, and very kindly too, someone coming to meet you afterwards, and she said, no, I haven't told anybody, with tears in her eyes. And I thought, oh my God, thinking about the old days where we, illegal as we were, we had set up what we called a front, because we were criminals, so we could use that kind of language, a front and a place. The place was where the abortions were done. And at the front, all these people would be waiting for the women who had gone to have their abortions done. And so there would be, and little kids, they would bring their children, leave them at the front. They would come with a boyfriend or a husband or their mothers or, you know, their best friends. And now, when it's legal and everything's supposed to be okay, here's this woman saying, I didn't tell anybody. And I'm thinking, oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
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 You know, I had... For folks that may not have caught Judith on previous shows, Judith is a Jane who helped to get women connected with abortion services in Chicago.
Yes.
You know, and so that's the history that Judith is talking about. For my own history, in the late 80s, I worked at Feminist Women's Health Center for 4 years. At first as an advocate for patients and eventually as a clinic assistant and whatnot. And again, that I think even in the late 80s, that shame was there for some of the clients. But it has only increased as we see state by state passing these laws about making sure that a woman who is faced with deciding what to do with a pregnancy has to listen to a fetal heartbeat, you know, has to, you know, all of these laws that are really only there to shame women.
Yes, that's right.
There is no other purpose for them.
That is exactly right. And to manipulate them out of their choice to have an abortion.
And we've just seen a recent decision about crisis pregnancy centers, otherwise known as places that exist to lie to women, being protected as free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, I guess that's all above the board now. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, so you can just sort of bold-faced lie about medical processes and about biology. And
indeed.
And, you know, that's free speech. Cool.
Yeah, these people who tell folks that abortions can cause cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, completely crazy, off-the-wall things said with a straight face.
Yeah. But even in the late 80s, I had the experience more than once of talking to a woman who said with, you know, some reticence, some shame, that, you know, she is not pro-choice. She thinks abortion is bad.
But
in her circumstances, it only made sense because she was responsible. She did use contraceptive. She did everything right in her world, right?
Uh-huh.
And still, this is where she finds herself.
Mm-hmm.
But these other women.
Right. They aren't as good as she is.
You know, right.
Yeah.
And that distinction would always sadden me so deeply.
It's tragic and ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You often hear, and you may very well have heard in the work that you just described, of people who are seen day after day or week after week or month after month demonstrating in very ugly ways outside of clinics. And then suddenly they show up with an appointment. This is different, they say.
Yeah,
it's different because it's you this time, and you don't care enough about other people to understand the relationship between your life and the lives of others.
And that everyone has circumstances that make this decision make sense to them.
Yeah. And that is not uncommon.
Yeah, it's not. And it's that individual exceptionalism that just makes me smack my... It's a facepalm sort of moment.
Definitely. Yeah.
There's another... So now that we... Again, talking about these various phases, I'm going to ask you to read a poem from What If Your Mother that you read during the Pond Poetry reading a couple of weeks ago. I was lucky enough to catch you. And it's a poem on adoption.
Ah, yes, of course.
Because as an adoptee, that hit home in a way that very few pieces of writing have.
Ah, well, I'm a half adoptee myself. My mother died when I was very small, and my father married again. I was raised by a stepmother who went to court to adopt me and my older brother. So I have just the tinge of experience of what that means. Okay, wait, now I have to find the page.
While you're finding the page, I will remind people you're listening to KBOO Portland. It's your community radio station. If you would like to call us, we have about 10 minutes left for your calls, and you can do that at 503-231-8187. You'll want to stay tuned to KBOO all morning long at 9 o'clock. We have Pacific Underground coming on with musician Joe Kai, who will be playing live in the studio and talking about his upcoming shows and his experience in becoming a U.S. citizen. And then there's so much more going on throughout the morning. Also, at 11:30, you can tune into our stream on the internet. We'll be webcasting live from Occupy ICE Portland Encampment. And you can get to that at kboo.fm and follow the link there to listen live to our web stream from Occupy ICE this morning at 11:30 with Ken Jones hosting. You can also support KBOO and the work we do here by going to our website, kboo.fm, and hitting the donate jar. You got it, Judith?
I do. This is the one called Sealed Birth Records Challenged in Court.
Yes.
Yes? Okay. There are, by the way, other adoption poems in here. I remember thinking about my stepmother's need/desire to have a child of her body, and she did. She got my older brother and me when we were part of the package with my father, which she clearly accepted amiably enough. But that knowledge in me as a small child, and even as a middle-sized child, that she wanted, needed, spoke of to make this other person, was a part of my consciousness, and no doubt part of the reason that I still think and feel and write about adoption the way that I do. So, okay, this one. Sealed birth records challenged in court. In the old days, everything was secret. You went away to what they called a home, or you stayed inside your own, hiding your belly when you knew you could not keep it. All the signs were danger signs, breasts heavy with yellow cream, darkening nipples, widening hips, desires for food, sex, sleep, all growing with the child, while you stood wide-footed, moving side to side like a broad-bottomed boat, riding the long tide, going out without you. Salty water shifting with a small internal moon until eclipse, when they took the child away, and you'd never see it, never know its name, never know if the eyes darkened, mind sharpened, curious about you, if they talked about you, if they said you were first, said you held the baby first.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I actually received a serious and useful criticism from another Portland woman, a poet and writer of prose, who said that she found that I had neglected one of the valuable voices in the set of adoption poems. I wish I could remember, I haven't thought about this for a while. I wish I could remember the words. But ever since then, I have tried every time I'm dealing with a particular theme or set of concerns. I remember that earnest, intelligent, talented woman saying to me, but what about this? And I thought, man, she's right. So, and particularly about something as deep as adoption.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did we ever talk about the movie Philomena?
No.
Oh, did you see it?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, Annie, you must, as soon as the show's over, you must go and get that movie from Movie Madness or wherever.
Okay.
Yes, and watch it. There is also a documentary that was at our wonderful resource, the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland, and they showed that doc and had a little panel of people talking about adoption. Which was quite useful sometime in the last couple of years. Anyway, definitely.
All right.
And then we'll talk about it.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. And so we only have just a few minutes left. And I want to sort of fast forward to the latest work that you've published. Yes. And as we were talking shortly before the show went on, looking at life experiences, looking at, how is it you worded yourself now, a genuine older person, a genuine old person?
Right, yeah, I used to call myself an entry-level old person when I was in my late 60s, but now I'm 75 and I have full rank.
That is fabulous. And, you know, as somebody who is entering, well, I'm in 2 weeks, I get the I get to be 52.
Okay.
And my partner just turned 60, and and we're looking at the world in like this way of, okay, I get it. I'm no longer a part of the youth movement. Okay, I get it. All right, we're aging. We are getting older. And to see how that has affected our interplay with the rest of the world and the world's interplay with us has been interesting. And you have this wonderful poem in, I can't say the name of this book, and I never, Announcements from the Planetarium. I have tried a few times to say the name of this book, and I always screw up the words. I don't know.
But I think it has to do with the number of syllables. And somebody said to me, that title has too many syllables, but I kept
love
it anyway.
I totally love it. And yet, so sorry to miss the name of that.
Yeah.
But you have this wonderful poem about older women becoming invisible or to be erased.
Yeah. I do, in fact. You're right. And I love that poem, but with your permission,
please.
Yes, because of what you said about yourself and your partner, I was thinking that I would like to read these two. One's very tiny, and one's small to medium.
Yeah.
Okay. This is called John Paul, George, and Ringo Thought About It. Now we know the answer to the Beatles' questions asked when I was not yet 30, but wondering, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Turns out, some will, some won't. And then this other one, which immediately sprang to mind while you were talking, Blessings on You, is called Are We There Yet?
Yes.
Once I was a baby. Twice I was a child. Three times I grew up thinking, ah, this is it. I'm 40. I'm 50. 60. This is the number. I'm all grown up. This is the grown-up thing. Maturity, wisdom, all they keep talking about. I've gotten to it now. But life kept on as before, so I could see I wasn't there yet. There'd be more to learn, to know, to understand and do. When would I uncover the secrets? 70? Surely that'd be old. Really old, right? Even if it's only the first gate, rusted and creaking open.
Judith, thank you for that.
Thanks for letting me read those.
Oh, absolutely. We have only a minute left. So just to sort of conclude, for folks that are interested in finding your work, connecting with you, perhaps seeing readings that may be coming up, how can people find out what you're doing?
Well, of course, I have a website, because I live in the moment. And the website is, naturally, because it was made some time back, juditharcana.com. And there is a writing page, and the writing page has pictures of all the books. And if you click on the pictures, you find information about the books, where to buy them. In most cases, you can get them directly from the publisher. The older ones that are out of print, they're in the library, or you can get them from interlibrary loan if our local doesn't have them. So juditharcana.com.
Thank you for coming on Positively Revolting again this morning and talking about how poetry can deepen our understanding of the world around us and the importance of words in our life. Thank you so much for sharing with us this morning, Judith.
Thank you for inviting me. It literally has been a treat.
Absolutely, for myself as well. And, you know, tune on in again next week. You will find more Positively Revolting. And stay tuned right now for Pacific Underground.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. KABU will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on Oregon Community Media radio stations from Ashland and Astoria to Warm Springs. Again, that's the 31st annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th, noon to 10 p.m. or so, every night at Waterfront Park in Portland and on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yes, yes, y'all. It's 9 o'clock in the a.m. on Friday at KBOO Portland, which means it's time for Pacific Underground. This month, musician Joe Kai plays live and talks about his upcoming shows and his experience becoming a U.S. citizen. There's more, and I'll tell you about it after the show, so stay tuned.